You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we have a show full of ironies, quests for justice, the value of art, and the value of a personal contemplative workspace, a place where you can make a huge mess in the pursuit of your creative goals. Artists have studios. I love that. We've been hearing from you, though, in the places that make your creativity come alive.
This is Josiah Wetzel from St. Louis, Missouri. I feel more creative and productive in a non-secluded, yet slightly apart, well-lit, and moderately quiet space that has good coffee, a big table, and if the task requires it, fast connectivity.
Thanks, Josiah. Describe your private creative space, contemplative or otherwise. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But we begin this hour on a note that is anything but contemplative. A super typhoon, Haiyan, one of the strongest storms ever recorded on the planet, made landfall in the Philippines, flooding streets and knocking out power and communication networks across this country of isolated islands. A predicted storm surge of 23 feet has caused the evacuation already of about 125,000 people. Aaron Aspey is the emergency communications officer for the NGO World Vision. He joins us from the Philippine city of Bohol. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, John.
Are you okay there right now? You're dealing not only with this storm, but the aftermath of a recent earthquake.
Yes, I'm now here in the quake hit areas in Bohol Island. And after the rains and the fierce winds, efforts are now focused on clearing operations as well as search and rescue. There are lots of landslides and destroyed roads, bridges, and other infrastructures that have been structurally weakened by the quake 3 weeks ago. Families are now displaced, and they are in cramped conditions in evacuation centers. And tonight, they are exposed to extreme weather, which also leaves them susceptible to coughs, colds, diarrhea, and other illnesses due to hygiene and sanitation concerns.
Aaron, are you getting any reports, any information about what the impact of this typhoon has been nationwide in the Philippines?
Yes. So far, our casualties are starting to pick up, but this could easily rise by the hour as we establish the full extent of damage brought by Typhoon Haiyan. And right now, around 154,000 people are in evacuation centers, and it's still rising. And the urgent needs there are ready-to-eat food, water, medicines, blankets, and sleeping mats. And here in the quake hit areas, people are still afraid to go to enclosed spaces, and they're urged to evacuate to sturdy structures, but some of them chose to stay in makeshift tents because they're still feeling aftershocks as of the moment.
Aaron, I'm amazed that we're even able to talk to you today. What do you think the requests will be, the most urgent requests for the international community in the early going here in the next few days?
Yeah, there's really massive challenges that lay ahead for humanitarian workers to work together with the government and with the disaster-affected communities for swift relief, rehabilitation, and recovery work.
And that's going to be nationwide. That's not just on the island where you are. That's across the Philippines.
Yes, it will be a massive relief operations that will be participated in by disaster units from different parts of the country with the help of the different agencies like World Vision.
Aaron Aspey is emergency communications officer for the NGO World Vision. He spoke to us from the city of Bohol. Aaron, stay safe. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is AT&T in cahoots with the government on private consumer phone data? You might be excused for answering yes to that after the reports that AT&T is being paid more than $10 million a year to assist the CIA by searching its databases and providing records of calls that may be helpful in identifying terrorism suspects. This cooperation with the CIA is entirely voluntary. According to the reports, AT&T is not acquiescing under subpoenas or court orders in any way. If you go to AT&T's website, they'll click on their privacy policy. It reads, "We will not sell your personal information to anyone for any purpose, period." Okay, so $10 million a year from the CIA, and we will not sell your personal information, period. There's a discrepancy there. So I called up AT&T customer support. I am a customer. Are you guys selling my data? And can I get a piece of it if you are?
Sir, we're not selling your data.
Yes, you are.
Sir, I have no comment. I cannot give you any information about that because I have not heard of such information. Now, if you have further questions about it, then we would refer you to the government agencies that are doing that, if they're doing that.
The CIA, according to government officials, is paying AT&T more than $10 million a year. Any way I can get a piece of that?
No, sir. No, there's no such program in place that we are aware of, and there's no way for you to make any money off of it.
Well, I don't want to make any money. I just would love to get my bill reduced a little.
Well, then let's see if there's a plan for you that would work better.
Did you get a plan with the CIA to arrange this $10 million a year thing?
Sir, that's not even a fair question. We don't have any knowledge of such a thing.
All right. Well, you know what? Why don't I just check with you maybe a little bit later? You've been very helpful.
All right. Well, I do apologize. I wish I could be more of assistance. No. All right. Well, you have a good day, sir.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Looks like AT&T is not necessarily going to be terribly responsive here. I don't blame them for that. But joining us now to weigh in is Susan Crawford, a professor at Cardozo Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry, A Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Welcome, Susan.
Great to be here.
So is it a fair question or an unfair question for me to try as a consumer to get a piece of that $10 million a year?
Well, let's just expand the question. AT&T says that over 2007-2011, it was actually paid $24 million by the federal government, and then add up all the other telcos you're paying bills to, and then add up the 51 federal agencies that are charging for all kinds of access to consumer records. This is a big issue. I don't think consumers are going to be paid back. I think taxpayers should be worried about how much is going to all this waste.
There's two issues here. One is the government paying for things that seem to violate privacy. That's one sort of legal construct. The other legal construct is maybe it's commercial. I mean, this data has huge value. If the government's willing to pay that much, how much would other companies, marketing firms, that sort of thing, be willing to pay for it? And what's the legal recourse there? You want to take either one of those?
You know, this is difficult because it's clear that the ability to track a consumer has enormous value for private companies and for the government. And it's unclear that consumers have any way of capturing that value for themselves. It's really a one-way transaction at this point.
What do you think the deal would have been if AT&T executives were in a room with the CIA? All right, for $5 million, we'll give you the Eastern Seaboard. We'll throw in Florida for another $6 million. I mean, I just don't understand how a deal like this is even structured. Is there any sort of legal template here that you understand?
Well, actually, AT&T furnished a schedule of the charges that it incurs for these kinds of wiretaps and other tracking mechanisms. They say they're not even recovering their costs, that it's much more expensive than the $10 million that they charged the FBI to hand over this information. But the larger question is, the whole point is that the CIA is not supposed to be doing domestic surveillance, and AT&T is not supposed to be handing over information unless they have the right legal process in their hands. And we're not clear about either of that.
Is there any precedent in U.S. history of telecom companies, telephone companies, communications companies being in cahoots in an explicit sort of business way with the government on national security matters that precedes the cell phone era?
Ever since the Civil War, the telecommunication companies have been cooperating, not so much making it a profit center. That's new. And the telephone companies' charges here are wildly different. Verizon charges different amounts than AT&T. Sprint, T-Mobile, they're all doing different things. But the cahoot stuff has been going on for a very long time.
Does the government have the right to compel a company to hand over information, whether they pay for it or not?
Well, the statute says the company's not supposed to hand it over unless they get legal process that suffices. But we know that the AT&T has a history of being very casual about how much process it requires. In 2010, AT&T employees actually moved into FBI offices. Uh-huh. And the FBI guys were just giving post-it notes to AT&T and asking for data about customers. They evaded the process almost absolutely. They were just looking over the shoulders of the AT&T employers who were looking into their databases about American subscribers. That abuse was just a couple of years ago, and we don't know if they've cleaned up their act after that.
As a law school professor, do you view this payment by the government to AT&T as essentially a license to get around having to actually get a subpoena to get it for free?
They could all be in cahoots. Everybody does better if they cooperate. AT&T makes some money. The government gets the data that it needs. Everybody feels as if they're helping the country. The problem is there's no accountability. These kinds of abuses led to the Church Committee examinations in the 70s, where we tried to rein in domestic surveillance. We seem to be recapitulating exactly what happened then.
Although the technology today makes it seem as though this is not a cat that can be put back, a horse that can be put back in the barn, whatever you want to say. This doesn't go back in the box.
It looks as if they're going to be vacuuming up data without constraint. The question is whether there's any oversight as to who has access to that data, how it gets used, where it flows. And the charging question is troubling. If companies are actually using this as a profit center, that seems to undermine the entire notion of protecting Americans' privacy.
Until judges are turned into apps that can actually evaluate data on a real-time, moment-to-moment basis. It seems like there's no way to keep up with this in the traditional sort of get a subpoena process.
I'm optimistic that a truly accountable technical system could be set up that would allow us to watch where data is going and be much more efficient about stopping data flows that are inappropriate and abusive. That does seem to be our only hope at this point.
And they probably could work on something like that up at MIT or Harvard in addition to dealing with the law. Susan Crawford is co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, professor of law at Cardozo Law School, and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
By the way, we asked AT&T spokesman Mark Siegel about this. He said, in all cases, whenever any governmental entity anywhere seeks information from us, we ensure that the request and our response are completely lawful and proper. We ensure that we maintain customer information in compliance with the laws of the United States and other countries where information may be maintained. Like all telecom providers, we routinely charge governments for producing the information provided. We do not comment on questions concerning national security. Mark Siegel decided he didn't want to go on the air. Later this hour, an artist talks about how her studio space influences her creativity.
As an artist, you do have to kind of create, even if it's psychologically, a space in order to make work.
We're asking you all this hour, what are the spaces that bring out your most creative and productive sides? From Salem, Oregon, it's not so much a physical space as knowing I have a block of uninterrupted time. Then turn on the radio and work. Paul Sussman from Ellis, New Jersey. I feel most creative and productive mentally in a library with real books, real magazines and newspapers, and real human librarians who can assist you. Nothing virtual. Love those. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. So to Washington now. The Senate votes, the House refuses to act. This frustrating pattern is playing out once again on Capitol Hill in a scenario that looked a little more positive earlier this week, but now is more of a puzzle. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, better known as ENDA, it's a bill that bans workplace discrimination against LGBT individuals, passed in the Senate yesterday with 10 Republican votes. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, welcome.
Hi, John.
So Senate Republicans seem to have been convinced on ENDA, some of them anyway. Is the House movable here?
That's part of the question here. Let's just recap real quick to make sure that people know. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act does ban workplace discrimination for LGBT people. Like you said, it exempts any employer less than 15 employees and has a broad exception for religious institutions, churches, and the like. So we just have to make a note of that. John, is the House movable as part of the question around Washington? I wanted to sort of find out. And a lot of this is behind the scenes Washington politics. There's some big money Republican wealthy donors trying to back an effort to change Republican minds on this. One of the chief lobbyists is a former senator, Norm Coleman, a Republican from Minnesota. Remember the guy who was locked in that tight race with Al Franken a couple years ago? He's still in Washington. Norm Coleman has been hired by a lobbyist. He works at a firm called Hogan Lovells. And I sat down with him because part of his job is to go behind the scenes, knock on doors with colleagues and former colleagues, and try to convince them to support this new gay rights bill. Listen.
The bottom line is, from a Republican perspective, we're the party of Lincoln. Our roots are in anti-discrimination. I've always viewed this issue as an economic issue. This is the right for somebody to get a job, and for to get a job based on their ability to do the job. There's specific provisions in this bill that say it's not about quotas. We're not the quota party. So Republicans should be very comfortable with the notion that somebody should be judged by their ability to do the job, and that's what this bill says. So for gays, lesbians, transgender, and bisexuals.
Meanwhile, the Speaker, John Boehner, put out a statement before the weekend saying not only was he against this bill for various reasons, but that it wasn't likely to see a vote to be brought up in the House. The fact that the House won't take it up sort of runs counter to what you're saying. What do you make of it?
Well, I think we simply have to do some work in the House. We've focused our conversation on the Senate. When this bill first came up and the Senate came out of committee, it had four Republican votes. Today, the bill is heard on the floor, final passage, and there are 10 Republican votes. So we've made progress, and probably made progress because we engaged in a thoughtful discussion about why Republicans should support this bill, why, as I've said before, that this bill is about the opportunity to earn a living, why this bill is about prohibiting discrimination, and why this bill, by the way, has a strong religious exemption, which was strengthened on the floor by Senator Portman. I understand the Speaker's concerns, and I'm sure he's taken the pulse of the conference, but I am hopeful that thoughtful discussion will result in an ability to move people, and that hopefully and it will become law.
What do you get back during some of these discussions when you talk to Republicans who don't want to vote for it? Do you get, my constituents can't handle me voting for something pro-gay? I mean, what do they say?
I think there are three issues that three issues that principally come up. First, gay marriage is an issue that many in my party don't support. I have not supported marriage equity, and yet I support ENDA. I've separated the two. One is about discrimination, as I said, an economic issue. The other is a social issue. The second issue comes up, litigation. Is this going to unleash another, more flurry of litigation? Is it going to make it harder for small business people to grow jobs? We're the jobs party. And so you have sensitivity about jobs. And we come back and say this bill doesn't impact, by the way, small business, employers with 15 employers or less. The states that have had this legislation have not resulted in a flurry of litigation. And then the religious protection. A concern among some members that the religious protection provision isn't strong enough. We believe it is. It was strengthened on the floor for an amendment from Senator Portman, I think Senator Ayotte, in the Senate bill. But those issues of litigation, of is this a gay marriage bill, or is this going to somehow violate people's right to have their religious beliefs, those are issues that come up, and we have to have a conversation to explain why those issues should not, those concerns should not prevent someone from voting for this bill.
All right, so Norm Coleman, Todd, comes from the Twin Cities, relatively progressive. I'm wondering if he is persuasive on this subject. Maybe you really need somebody from the Deep South who can deliver this message.
And the Deep South is the place where those 10 Republican votes in the Senate yesterday, John, didn't produce any votes. There were a couple in the Northeast. There were some in the West, some in the Midwest, none in the South. So you raise a good point. But look, part of Norm Coleman's message here is for the Republican Party writ large. The Republicans, after the loss of 2012 and the loss of 2008, have told themselves in documents that have been made public, they need to reach younger voters. They need to stop talking just to themselves. They need to steer clear of divisive social issues. Part of Norm Coleman's message when he talks to Republicans is, hey, this party needs to change direction a little bit. This can help us do it. So listen to this.
I think there's been an empathy gap in our party. Supporting this bill, I think, is a positive way to send a very positive message about who we are, about empathy, about fighting discrimination, about reaching out to certainly younger voters who are on this issue. The numbers are overwhelming. And by the way, the numbers among Republican voters are pretty strong. this anti-discrimination bill supported between 60 to 70% of the public in most states across the country, and by a majority of Republicans, about 56% of Republicans. And in fact, what's fascinating is about over 80% of Americans think it's already the law. So they think the law is already there. They support it overwhelmingly, and Republicans support it in a majority support. So in the end, as I said, we've got work to do with my friends in the House. But I really do believe that a thoughtful discussion is important, is necessary to take place, and hopefully at some point in time will have some impact.
To underscore, a lot of work to do there in the House, right, Todd?
There is quite a bit of work, John, and it's really a question of incentives. Don't forget, we're headed into 2014, a midterm election, what the conventional wisdom calls a base election. Not really an incentive for a member from a conservative district or a gerrymandered district to reach the broad middle. The incentive is to reach the base. Does the base want this? Big question, maybe not. Maybe the best thing for supporters of ENDED to do is to wait until after this election when we're heading into 2016.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick's conversation with Republican former Senator Norm Coleman. You can listen to it online at thetakeaway.org. Todd, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Our Movie Friday moment with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. You can get a lot more of that moment with both of them on the Movie Date podcast that they co-host at thetakeaway.org. Rafer, Kristen, welcome.
Hi, John.
So it's hammers and books and drugs is the theme.
That's
this
right.
Week.
We need in life to be happy.
Let's start with Thor, The Dark World.
I know you seek vengeance as much as I do. You help me escape Asgard, and I will grant it to you. Vengeance. And afterward, this cell.
You must be truly desperate to come to me for help. What makes you think you can trust me?
I don't.
All right, you guys. I always thought Thor was the original Jump the Shark comic book hero. What do you think of this movie, Kristen?
I thought this was awful. This is a terrible, terrible movie. In this movie, it's a sequel to the first Thor movie. We have Natalie Portman's character has been infected with some sort of terrible element that can take down all of civilization. Thor's going to rescue her. But along the way, most of us, I think, are going to fall asleep.
Love the cast, but still doesn't work, eh, Rafer?
No, it really doesn't. It takes itself so seriously. It's really like an interminable session of Dungeons and Dragons. It's just guys talking in grand accents about things like the cursed and the ether and the Malekith.
But Iron Man can joke, but Thor can't joke.
Thor does not joke. Yeah. I don't know why, but he never jokes.
All right, the next movie, The Dallas Buyers Club. Let's listen.
Rayon, the whole purpose of this study is to determine if AZT is helping people.
Come on, Evie, you know there ain't no helping me.
That doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying.
Why are you so good to me? Bless your little heart.
Shut up. Just promise me you'll show up for the rest of the trial.
I promise you that I will try my very best.
I want you to mean it.
Romance, righteousness, Matthew McConaughey. What can go wrong in this movie about the AIDS crisis? Dallas Buyers Club.
Nothing goes wrong in this film as far as I'm concerned. I think this is Matthew McConaughey's breakout, potentially Oscar role. He plays an AIDS victim in the mid-80s, not gay, straight, kind of classic redneck homophobe who turns to importing unapproved drugs and selling them to other AIDS victims. It's a pretty straightforward movie, but Matthew McConaughey's performance is so amazing. He lost 38 pounds to play the role. He's fantastic in this movie.
The Philadelphia of our time, Kristen?
Oh, it's so much better than the Philadelphia of our time. I feel that Philadelphia was scared of its subject matter. This embraces it. It runs with it. And watching a movie about the AIDS crisis in the 80s sounds so tragic, but you actually will be cheering in this movie. It's one of the best movies of the year.
That is a huge rave from you two. And more about that on the podcast this week?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, because when you guys rave, you really rave. The Book Thief. Let's hear our last offering here.
So let me guess. You forgot where the front door was. I've got to hand it to you, Salmensch. You've got guts. Stealing from the Burgermeister.
Keep it down. I'm not stealing. I'm borrowing.
Well, whatever you're borrowing, just wish you let me in on it.
Hugely popular book, of course. Surprising that this hasn't already been made into a movie. Kristen, what did you think?
The acting is fantastic. We have Emily Watson. We have Jeffrey Rush. Little Sophie Nalisse there plays the main character, the book thief. Beautifully shot. Music by John Williams. The movie is so good, except the framing device, specifically a narrator who is way too jolly and way too jaunty and kind of throws the tone off for me.
Narrator kills it. Rafer?
I think it's just a really treacly version of the horrors of World War II, and I felt it was just a little too schmaltzy for such a serious subject for my taste.
Movie Date Podcast, what do you got?
We are going to be talking about chick flicks for dudes. One of our listeners for Movie Therapy really wants some therapy on chick flicks for dudes.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date Podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
You
Thanks,
too, John.
You too.
In a moment, the story of art lost and art found.
We are preparing and have a draft of a claim to be made to the German government asking for the restitution as promptly as possible of this particular painting.
That's Marianne Rosenberg. She will tell the story of how a painting, a Matisse, stolen by the Nazis from her art dealer grandfather's collection, has been found in Germany. It's an amazing story of the post-war world and the art world today. But getting that Matisse back with restitution from the German government may be difficult. We reached out to Dr. Imke Gehlen. She's a Berlin-based lawyer specializing in restitution claims in Germany. For even the Rosenbergs, Gehlen says, getting restitution will be a long process.
Well, the first step that you always have to take is you have to do the research into what the families exactly lost. I mean, many families may not even know exactly what they lost. I mean, they know that they lost art or that their family had art collections, but they do not know exactly what paintings were part of the art collection. So this is the first step to find out what exactly was lost. Then the next step is, of course, to find all the documents proving that you were once owner of those paintings, and then also obtain some information on how they were lost.
Is restitution an easy task in Germany? If you have all that documentation, is restitution something that the German government is likely to grant, or is it a politically sensitive topic right now?
Well, of course, it's always a sensitive topic, but one has to say that during the last 14 years since all this started, 1998-99, in Germany, many, many paintings and art objects have been returned. And if an object is in a public museum and you have the basic documents, then your chances that you will get restitution are very good, are quite good. Good, I would say.
And in the Gerlich case, is there the responsibility of the German government to sell off those assets and then compensate people insofar as they can be found and individual objects can be linked to individual victims? Who takes this to the next step?
Well, that is exactly what is the difficulty at the moment, because, I mean, first of all, this is a procedure right now in the prosecution in Augsburg, which is a city in the state of Bavaria, and Germany, like the United States, is a federal state. So the federal government, for example, that has signed this Washington Declaration principles in 1998, does not have the power to instruct a prosecutor in Augsburg to do anything. So this is the first problem. They can maybe only offer some help. And it's not clear yet that all these paintings will be sold off and compensated. I mean, this is an ongoing criminal procedure, which is still on the first level that they seem to be investigating against this Mr. Gurlitt for tax reasons or misappropriation. Nobody really knows the details. So it's not clear yet if how it will end and if things can be or will be taken from him so that they can be returned to possible Jewish families who have found something in that collection there.
What do you think the possibility of a broader restitution outside of very individual claims is here? Will people besides the Rosenbergs be contacted about the possibility of restitution based on this Munich discovery?
Well, I'm hopeful that even if they're not contacted, that at one point the paintings are published and then heirs can find them. I know of, I think there's one other painting, the Liebermann painting, which a family has already identified. So I'm hopeful that also other heirs will find their paintings once they are published. And then, of course, one should approach the prosecution office there and already lodge a claim and then try to find a way with the prosecution and then find a way to get a solution.
Dr. Imke Gillen is a Berlin-based lawyer specializing in restitution claims in Germany. Doctor, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
The German government attempts to prosecute and otherwise deal with the trove of more than 1,400 artworks worth $1.4 billion, art confiscated from Jews by the Nazis or sold quickly and cheaply by Jews fleeing Nazi rule. The art found in Munich 2 years ago but only made public this week. Collectors and dealers around the world are all abuzz. They wonder if this might be another chance to get stolen works returned. As we mentioned, one of the owners of at least one of the pieces in the recently discovered trove in Munich was Paul Rosenberg, a leading French art dealer of his day who was a victim of the Vichy regime in France under Nazi occupation. At least 400 works worth millions of dollars were taken. The family has been searching for their lost artwork ever since, including that famous Matisse. Marianne Rosenberg is Paul Rosenberg's granddaughter. She's an attorney here in New York and continues her family's quest to recover their lost masterpieces.
The story itself is truly stranger than fiction. The idea of these extraordinary works stashed in this one room with rotting food and old cans is just very, very hard to believe. My reaction, I was alerted a few days before this broke that they might be a painting that belonged to my grandfather in the lot. We got very little information. We still have gotten no information officially except they flashed up on the screen the photograph of the Matisse, the woman holding a fan, which is indeed registered as a lost piece in my grandfather's archives and in the inventory that we maintain.
Did you know this image? Did you know this painting?
Yes, we knew the painting. It was one that we were searching for, as we have searched for all the other ones since the end of the war, relentlessly. We had a photograph of it, a black and white inventory card that was taken before the war. And it was only when we saw it up on the screen during that press conference that for the first time we saw it in color.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it is a extraordinarily beautiful painting, but to be revealed to us sort of in living color was a very strong moment.
What was it like for your grandfather as an art collector? And what did the coming of the war and the ascendance of the Nazis do to those businesses, to those collectors?
My grandfather dealt with top art and only top quality art, but amongst other things, he also represented Picasso, Braque, Matisse, Léger, Marie-Laurent Saint, many others. And in an act of complete insult to my grandfather, who was a legendary figure and a very brilliant man, the Vichy government actually took away his French nationality because he was Jewish and because he had fled the country. And so they considered the works that had been left in France as quote-unquote abandoned.
And so what becomes of this art at this point? And the idea that it was sort of lost in limbo in this apartment of Gerlitz's heir, essentially paying for his rent on some level.
Well, it is extraordinary because the younger Gerlitz, Cornelius, in fact, was the man who didn't exist. He had no a social security number did not exist for the German government, completely lived under the radar, no rights to pension. He had no identity at all. And so he lived undercover, obviously, with certain galleries and auction houses who were prepared to deal with him, presumably for cash. Who knows? What happens to the art is complicated. It's complicated because the German authorities have refused to date to disclose and publish the list of arts, of the objects, which they obviously have because they repossessed this at least a year and a half ago, perhaps longer. They've had ample time to do an inventory, and they could easily put all that information on the web, and they have refused to do so. We are one of the lucky ones because they flashed the picture of the very prominent Matisse up there, and so clearly ours comes in a separate category. In that trove of things that they found, there are obviously things that were looted. They were things that were probably exchange. There were things that were probably pressured to be sold in those absolutely anxiety-driven years of 38, 39, where people were selling everything they had for a safe passage. They were things that were probably recovered after the war and never returned. It's going to be an absolute mixed bag of items. And we have never – the Rosenberg family has never stopped searching since 1945. My grandfather started before the end of the war. Once – the minute Paris was liberated, he started to recover and try to recover objects. And we have never stopped that quest. It was first through him, Paul Rosenberg, then my father, Alexandre Rosenberg. My mother, Elaine Rosenberg, toils on it daily through the archives. And now the younger generation, my cousin Ann, my sister Elizabeth, and myself continue on with the quest. And we have recovered all sorts of art, some that have of very little value, and we pursue them equally because what matters is the moral principle of recovering these arts that were stolen while my family's lives were destroyed.
Is there a particular image, a particular piece of art that has sentimental value to you that you would love to recover that would somehow signify that you are getting to the end of the story?
I think we will be at the end of the story when the list of 60 remaining lost items has been all crossed off. I think there are maybe two items that come to mind. One is a Picasso portrait drawing of my aunt, which would be absolutely lovely for my cousin Anne to recover. I'm sure it would mean a great deal to her. And then there is the Degas portrait of Mademoiselle Dieu, which we nearly recovered a few years ago. And as soon as we made an approach, it went underground again. And it was something that used to hang, I believe, in my grandfather's office. And it would be just a lovely gesture of honor and homage to him as he deserves.
Well, the best of luck and all success in your very arduous journey here.
Thank you.
Marianne Rosenberg, attorney and granddaughter of Paul Rosenberg, a leading French art dealer who lost most of his collection to the Nazis during World War II. From art objects to the process that creates them, artists have studios. I've always envied that. Next up on The Takeaway, what space makes you feel most creative and productive?
This is Charmaine. I'm calling from Massachusetts. When I'm writing, a comfy chair near a fireplace gets my creative juices flowing. In warm weather, it's a nice spot under a big, shady tree.
Tell us about your workspace, 8778-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Continuing our discussion of art and creativity, do you have a place to go where your creativity switches on in some way? A desk, the room of one's own, of Virginia Woolf. A studio, a perch on a hill somewhere. For painter Jackson Pollock, it was a floor. His paintings were born on a floor in a now famous cottage on Long Island in New York.
The modern artist has found new ways of expressing the world about him. I happen to find ways that are different from the usual techniques of painting. I paint on the floor, and which isn't unusual, as the Orientals did that.
A new book reckons to allow a reader to stumble into the places where artists work, places that allow them to build and dream. Art Studio America, Contemporary Artist Spaces, features the spaces of 115 artists active today, including Chuck Close, Kiki Smith, Bill Viola, Marina Abramovic, and others. In each space, the book's editor and interviewer, Hossein Amousadeghi, deliberately intrudes and draws each artist into a conversation while the pictures show dozens of magical spaces where the modern art world comes alive. Amousadeghi and one of the artists featured, Brooklyn-based film and video artist Lorna Simpson, came into our radio studio this week to talk about how important a creative space is and how it is all about work.
Really, the kind of main space of mine has this kind of panoramic window, which is kind of cinematic. And it really does feel that way. So it's this kind of beautiful space that has skylights and is very airy, gigantic ceilings. And funny enough, it's really very flexible in terms of being able to shoot video projects in there, sound projects, drawings. Like, it's a very flexible space. So it actually is like this sanctuary that, even though I might have a mile-high list of things to do, when I walk in there, it's my own kind of private sanctuary.
You know, Sanctuary was the title of the book you did, Hossein, on the British artist spaces that is a companion for this book here. What's the experience like of going into these spaces that both inspire the creativity of these artists and, in many cases, make huge messes all over the place?
The British artists, they have less space. They have less glamour, if you will. But the American space, for me, was a totally different experience because coming after Sanctuary and being in a small island as Britain, the American one is such a huge space. The expanse of the country, the dimensions of cultures and the multicultural environment, and the aura of Americana, which I found, to my own surprise, rather appealing in many ways.
Well, there's so many diverse spaces in this book in America. I mean, the difference between the studios on the West Coast, some of which are so playful and fabulous. I mean, I'm thinking of Billy Al Bankston, who has this almost like a storefront, a beautiful space, or Jim Shaw in Venice. It's almost like a theater space. And some of the New York spaces like yours, Lorna, you know, they run the gamut. As a non-artist, for me to be able to go into a space like yours or one of these industrial spaces like Rashid Johnson has, where it's you could fly an airplane in there, I mean, it's almost like I'm looking over your shoulder. Does that make you nervous?
Not at all. I mean, well, it depends. But I think in some ways, as an artist, you do have to kind of create, even if it's psychologically, a space in order to make work. And that if you know, that can be made in, like, in your bedroom, that could be made in the kitchen. But I think it's also, you know, artists choose spaces that they can kind of intellectually and psychologically create this arena for them to think. And then the work then comes out of that.
You know, and there's a curatorial piece to this as well, because some of the artists are actually using their studio spaces to collect materials that are fading away. I mean, in the case of Corey Archangel, who's collecting electronic lost, you know, sort of thrown away objects to use in his work. And there's also, you know, people collecting paper. Billboard paper is going away. And there are artists who store, you know, materials that are becoming obsolete as time goes on. That must have been fascinating to observe.
The Archangel and Mark Bradfield, he produces art for his little space, which is his mother's hair salon. His studio is a continuation of his mother's original hair salon where he learned them. To play with material and paper. So, again, what does represent Bradford's art is where he came from as a child, working, washing hair in his mother's hair salon, and then being taught by his mother to feel and textualize different textiles, etc., which he now uses in more, more or less themes in his art.
And then there are some studios that actually are a lot like galleries, where there are the work of the artist surrounding them completely. What is the psychological interior there, Hossein?
Well, they are the sort of original idea of the studio was the Renaissance idea of the artisanal workshop where the apprentices were brought in and participated in producing great masters' works. So take, for instance, Jeff Koons, who, as I describe in the book, has some 130 assistants working in a large space in Chelsea, and he is very hands-on supervising every aspect of it. In fact, he supervised the shoot as well himself. So
I just wonder if the Coons having 130 assistants is a commentary on Jeff Koons that maybe is very independent of his art. Having a space where you're controlling 130 people sounds more like, I don't know, General Electric than...
Well, if you can sell art at 20, 30 million pop, you can be General Electric of the art world. You know?
I guess that's right. For a conceptual artist like Maria Abramovic, what does a studio represent, do you think, in looking at the images here?
Well, I mean, I think Marina, her work is also about sculpture and about space and about her relationship of her body in that space and duration and time. And there's not always the expectation that you have to, like, make objects to have a space, because there are many different artists that work in video or film that kind of still require some kind of studio space, some kind of environment, as I said before, that they can kind of retreat to think about what they're making or how they make it or their relationship to duration and time and the body and being in a space.
It is about play and space, and I was thinking about all these spaces when just yesterday my 3-year-old and my 12-year-old on their tummies with the paper spread out, watercolors everywhere, making a huge mess and having the time of their lives. And I think it exactly mirrors the spaces that you've got here in this book.
Yes, and a lot of these artists are on their tummy or on their backs, and they're not having the time of their life because the intensity of the process and the production scheduling and next show and the gallery demands and all of that don't allow what would be child play. I mean, Picasso said that the greatest enemy of creativity is common sense. Now, as soon as an artist becomes commonsensical, if you will, the creativity does get necessarily stunted in a direction which has to produce for the market.
So you got to fight. So it's a fight, and the studio space is a sanctuary, but also, in a sense, a fighting space. It makes me sound like... we've got to get you out of here so you can get back home and get to work.
Yeah, I've got to get back to work.
Hossein and Lorna, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Hossein Amirsadeghi is the editor and interviewer in the new book, Art Studio America, Contemporary Artist Spaces, which explores the studio spaces of more than 100 famous artists, including Lorna Simpson.
This is Hugh Mead from Oklahoma City. I love the writer's cabins that I've seen, but I can't afford to have one. Also, I live in urban space, so it's harder to create the illusion of separation and privacy.
This is Bruce in Tallahassee, Florida. I find the best place to relax is down at my little house on the pristine Wakulla River in near Tallahassee, Florida. It's quiet, serene, natural, lets me work and think without clutter. Ah.
Tell us about the place that inspires you to be creative and do your best work. What does it look like, feel like? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE and send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program. You can check us out at thetakeaway.org. That's our creative space. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.